You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, could freedom of movement for citizens of the European Union really be at risk? The German Chancellor thinks so, and she's blaming an inability to manage the migrant crisis. I'll ask my studio guests, Roger Boys and Alessio Patilano, for their take. Plus, the Washington Post has yet again called upon Iran to exercise justice as it prepares to hand down a verdict in its espionage case against the newspaper's Tehran bureau chief. We'll also review the shortlist of contenders as New Zealand prepares to select its new flag. And as if Trump hadn't stirred the presidential pot quite enough, another celebrity makes his White House ambitions known.
As you probably could have guessed by this moment, I have decided in 2020 to run for president.
Music star Kanye West made that announcement at the MTV Music Awards. But when it comes to stunt campaigns, just what kind of impact do they have? That's all to come on Midori House, live from Studio One, with me, Andrew Tuck, starting right now. Well, as you can guess by that, we have quite a packed show. And my guests today are Roger Boys and Alessio Patilano. But Mr. Patilano is unfortunately a bit delayed. He's going to jump into the studio, hopefully in the next few seconds. But we're going to start today talking about immigration. Germany expects about 800,000 refugees this year, four times the number it received last year. That is, of course, in addition to those who don't get refugee status. But infighting is continuing between the nations in the European Union over who should bear more of the increasing pressure from the millions fleeing war and unrest. But the German Chancellor warned yesterday that a failure to reach any agreement over the coming weeks could threaten the very freedom of movement within the EU. Roger, an extraordinary moment in migration history, that the tide of people coming our way is really epic and extraordinary. That just tens of thousands of people. We've seen today the Hungarians shut down the main railway station in Budapest, saying they can't cope with the numbers. It's getting very fractious with, you know, what the French are saying about the Hungarians. But when we really look at this notion at the heart of this about the freedom of movement, we're seeing fences being put up, we're seeing border controls coming back in. Do you think that is kind of inevitable? And is it a good or bad thing? Does it really matter if we start having checks again at borders?
That's six questions.
It's a big topic.
Yes, I do think Europe's at some kind of breaking point, really. This has come, don't forget, on the top of a massive division over the Eurozone between creditor and debtor nations, the trans-Mediterranean migration, which divided the north and southern rim of the European Union, tensions on the east with East Europeans feeling that they're exposed to Putin and the West doesn't care enough. Chinese slowdown beginning to affect European growth prospects. It's massive. It's really, we are really at a frighteningly existential moment, really. I can't remember a moment except in the most positive way in 1989 and 1990 when the communist system collapsed. I can't remember quite such a moment. And Merkel's statement, well, as I understand Merkel's statement, which is that that we might have to reconsider the border-free or the passport-free borders within the Schengen zone, it was a conditional statement. It was conditional. She was basically threatening those countries that benefit most from the Schengen zone if they don't come up and agree with quotas and relieve some of the German burden.
Well, let's just begin to pick that apart. So we allow people to move freely throughout the European Union. Now, 800,000 people arriving in Germany. Now, Germany's being very magnanimous and being very generous, saying it will take these people, it will take every Syrian refugee. But in the end, it wants those people to move on to other nations as well. So is it in Germany's interest to actually have some border controls, Because in the end, if you sign on or if you agree that you're a refugee in any of the countries back down the line, that's where you stay. So while Germany says it doesn't really like the idea of the border, isn't it in Germany's interest even to begin to at least slow the process?
Well, first of all, there's not free movement throughout the European Union, only through the Schengen zone. That's to say the people who have signed up to the Schengen treaty. So there are a significant number of people outside it, including Britain. Yes, I think it's actually in everybody's interests in a way that border controls are resumed. I think that we have to, the Schengen Treaty allows that to happen in cases of emergency, to suspend the treaty and reimpose, usually only for a couple of weeks when there's the World Cup on, or recently when there was a big push from Italy into France. Then it's suspended for a week or two, or sometimes as much as a month. But I think there's now a real case for suspending it completely, maybe for a year or so, while other measures that are being taken, other sort of nudge measures that are being taken across the world, start to take effect. I mean, in all sorts of places. So I think Germany benefits from closing the borders, although, of course, it's the country with most borders in the European Union. And I think most others do, too. The people who don't benefit so much, I think, are the Eastern and Central Europeans, and that's who Merkel was threatening, really, by saying this, because they're taking almost no Syrian refugees, and she's basically saying, pull your weight, otherwise you're going to lose this this particular advantage of being in Europe.
But when we come to that notion of pulling your weight, it's great for, like, you know, Germany to say to poorer nations back down the line, you should be taking these people. The reality is they are poorer nations, and they tend to be slightly less, you know, cosmopolitan in some senses, in the sense that they're not often the ideal place for migrants to end up, because some of the smaller communities are not very open, they're not accessible to outsiders, and they just sit there in poverty. You need to send people to where there's opportunities for them to actually make some contribution, don't you?
Yeah, so that there is a strong case for saying that, especially as it's not just Syrians we're talking about. We're talking about a massive and a politically illogical emigration from the Balkans, Albanians and Macedonians and Kosovars and Serbs. They're all coming in quite big quantities. I mean, I was just looking at the statistics. Of the 192,000 people who registered for asylum in Germany in the first few months of this year, 42% were actually from the West Balkans. So there is a Syria problem, yes, but I think there is another one, which is the poverty problem, the poverty emigration problem, the people who are not fleeing war, but fleeing impoverishment, and who feel thwarted and frustrated because they're close to the European Union. European has promised some kind of enlargement process, which is not really happening, and maybe European doesn't even want it to happen, really. And so they come over and they get jobs, or they claim asylum. And if you're, say, an Albanian with six kids, you can claim 900 euros a month plus free medication and free food until your asylum application has been heard, which can take a year.
Yeah, and now, in many ways, you know, obviously, I think the Germans have said there should be no asylum for, you know, Albanians. Albanians come from a good country; they should remain there. But the reality is, you know, if you're on the other side of the fence, if you've created this situation where it is possible for you to get on a train, go to Western Europe because of the way that the Schengen Agreement works, and pitch up and get this money and potentially get a job, why wouldn't you do it? Because, you know, if you're sitting in poverty in Albania and you think there's an opportunity for you to improve the life of yourself and your kids, you know, any of us in this room would take that opportunity, wouldn't we? So once you've made that a feasible thing, it's kind of incredulous, really, to imagine that people are just going to sit still in kind of poverty and watch the opportunities float past them.
Yes, I mean, and I think most prosperous countries within the European Union are realistic about this, but what they want is the ability to send these people back as quickly as possible. And what's happening now is it takes a year to grant them asylum, and then they can appeal, which takes another 15 months, and then sometime in between they maybe disappear. They disappear within the Schengen zone, cross the border, and enter what might be called the Schengenland black market, black economy, or they go to other relatives in elsewhere. So this is a problem, but it's only part of the problem. The other problem is the basic, absolutely crucial humanitarian problem of Syria and indeed Eritrea, which is also you can also consider as a war zone.
Well, I'm glad to say that Alessio Patalano has sneaked into the studio. Welcome, Alessio. You know the topic we're talking about.
Yes.
We're talking about these huge numbers, 800,000 potentially sitting in Germany, hoping to get refugee status, hoping to be given asylum. But when we look at some of the numbers that have been taken by other countries, I'm intrigued. It's great that Sweden has taken so many people. But if you've come from, downtown Damascus and you suddenly find yourself posted up to Uppsala without a job and sitting on social income, that isn't a solution. So is in a way, the numbers being taken isn't the end of the game, is it? It's which of these nations are going to be most open to accepting people and bringing them into the mainstream? And here's the intriguing thing. There's a big fuss about, Slovakia saying, actually, we'd like to take, Christian migrants.
Mm.
We don't think that we would be able to absorb, Muslim migrants. And Germany said that that is not on. But the Spanish today said, actually, look, if that's the way you feel, at least, you're taking some people. What do you think about this idea that, it's not how many you take, it's what you allow people to do once they arrive?
Absolutely. I think you're spot on in the sense that here what we're looking at is at least two different type of problems. One is Angela Merkel talking about this issue as part of a domestic politics agenda. And therefore, in that context, of course, it makes sense to talk about numbers. And another one is the problem of are we just bringing these people in, sort of taking them in and put them in a corner, or do we want actually to do something about their situation? Do we want to try to integrate them? Do we want to give them an opportunity to think about their future and say, like, well, I want to stay here, maybe, or maybe go somewhere else? And I think that's a different type of problem. It's the bigger problem. It's the one you're alluding to, in which what is really missing around this debate is a serious discussion as to what should be the principles of how, again, I was reading on the point you were making about the number of people taken by Sweden, Germany, as opposed to other countries. Here is not just a question of how many people you take per capita numbers, is what do they do, looking at where they're coming from. And I think that kind of discussion hasn't happened yet because primarily, and that's where the two points connect together. Primarily so far, this has been a domestic politics debate, as if, just look around here in the UK, where most of the debate is, well, no, sorry, we're full. We don't want to get anyone on top of what we have already. So you don't really have a discussion as to, okay, this is a problem.
Let's be fair to the UK in a little bit. We say that, but we took 330 people last year, many of them from the European Union. Many of the people are, as Roger Boyes has pointed out, they're people who were economic migrants. They were coming from impoverished countries. That is 330,000 people matched with, in the UK, an electoral pressure, which is that, we don't have the housing for, people who are here already, many of whom are migrants, who we need to find housing for. It's a catastrophic situation, whichever way it works out. It's not going to end that nicely, is it, Roger?
No. Part of the problem is that the solutions lie outside Europe. But there are lots of interesting ideas going around, and they have to be brought together. One of them, for example, is these refugee camps around the borders of Syria in Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. They're cracking. These societies are cracking up. Lebanon's really on the brink because of the sheer force of these numbers. And one suggestion is that one could actually allow. And people have been there for 4 years, and these are the people who are coming. They're not coming directly. In most cases, they're not coming directly from Aleppo to here. They're coming from the refugee camps. So we have to get that sorted over there. And one of the ideas is that we allow them to work there, that we create economic zones so that they can actually contribute in, with whatever, car workshops or whatever, and vocational training. While they're in the camps, they've been there 4 years. That's 4 years of a kid's education. Mm. So that's my first point, that actually a lot of these solutions are outside Europe, and that we should be therefore not drawing inside ourselves, but actually becoming more offensive in terms of aid policy and looking for diplomatic solutions in Libya, for example. I mean, we really have to push harder for some kind of united government there. And the other issue which you raised with Alessio too, which is, you know, countries like Slovakia saying no or saying yes to refugees, but only on, only on the conditions that we give. I don't find that a bad thing. First of all, if you see the world from Slovakian eyes, you'll see that they've already had to bail out Greece, which is a significantly richer country than itself, because of its membership of the euro, and now it's being asked because it's, you know, it doesn't play any significant role at all in the foreign policy making of the European Union, and now it's being asked to accept willy-nilly a quota ordered by the European Commission of Syrians. And they're saying, well, actually, it shouldn't be the European Commission who's deciding these quotas, and it shouldn't be the asylum seekers themselves who decide where they want to go.
And they didn't take part in the war that kind of, you know, that in Libya, for example, that deposed. Alessio, I do want to ask you another question, which is this: you know, the Hungarians are getting it in the neck. You know, Orbán is being, you know, he is clearly, you know, a politician who is maverick, who plays right against left and communist against, you know, Europe. But, you know, this idea that he's building the fence, that he's the bad person. Let's just go to Calais. You know, we're surrounding Calais by fence after fence. That's the British and the French doing that to try and stop people. We're surrounded by sea. That's our advantage. But if you're a Slovakia or if you're Hungary, you don't have that opportunity. Is it, you know, are they getting unfair criticism for just trying to stop, you know, people crossing their borders without their permission?
I think to a large extent, yes, they are taking a degree of unfair criticism. And I think part of the problem is due to the fact that we treat these different angles of the same issue as separate. These are not mutually exclusive. You know, discussing the type of principles according to which you take or you not take a certain number of people should go alongside whether the solution just rests in Europe or one should actually try to do more to solve things in Libya, to try to create a better situation both in Lebanon as well as in Syria, as well as in Turkey. Let's not forget that Turkey also is coming to a point where the number of refugees in the country is beyond sort of the possibility for them to having them there. So these are different type of problems that, so long as they treated separately, you will always pick and choose and try to and be able to be in a situation where if you don't like what Slovakia is saying today, you're going to point a finger at them and say, like, sorry, that's not that way of looking at the problem because it's something else. I think the problem is this keeping things separate, whereas these are non-mutually exclusive issues that should be treated all at the same time. As you said, at the moment, for example, as a military sort of person, I look at the map of Europe. Yes, you're absolutely right. Eastern European countries have a land connection that allows them to be more exposed. Yes, to an extent. At the moment, by far, the largest sort of migration fluxes are coming through the sea. The question is, how is that happening? Why is that happening? Well, look at where they're coming from, Libya being one of the main embarkation points. Why are we doing more politically to put pressure in order to control that and preventing that from happening beforehand?
And I think, you know, there's another debate, Roger. We need to move on, but just quickly, there's another debate. Why is it the European countries which are only in this discussion? Because, you know, this is a Syrian communities have been very successful all around the world for many, many decades. You know, you go to Brazil, you go to Latin America, you go to Central America, you'll find very successful Syrian communities. Do you think it's actually time for some of these kind of more, you know, midway developing nations, the Brazils, the Mexicos, to say, actually, you know, we have opportunities here for business people. We could do actually with these technical people. We could do with the doctors, that there should be a bit more of a kind of a global discussion rather than it keep on coming down to what is the EU going to do?
Yes, of course, that's absolutely the case. And when you talk about, I'm constantly struck by this argument here about quotas, you know, how much should Luxembourg take, how much not. And we forget about the Arab states who are the ones who have been, who've been arguing for 4 years that that we've stood by, everybody has stood by, while Muslims got massacred by a dictator in Syria. And now there's time for some kind of responsibility, some kind of... But instead, the funds go through, for example, Saudi charities into Syria, and quite often are used, of course, to fund the jihad rather than for great humanitarian tasks. But this whole business of creating work zones, economic zones in the area of Syria so that people can return at some stage when the country needs rebuilding, that is something that should be funded and subsidised by the Middle East and by Arab countries in particular.
Now, we've got quite a lot to get in the next 10 minutes, but we're just going to quickly touch on one topic, which is the Washington Post bureau chief in Tehran is likely feeling rather tense at the moment because he's waiting to hear whether he'll spend the next few years in an Iranian prison. The 39-year-old Jason Rezaian has been detained for the past 13 months on charges of espionage. He and his family, along with the Washington Post, denied the allegations, with the newspaper issuing a statement last night calling for the nation to serve justice and reassure the international community. Just quickly on this, because we don't know the verdict. It doesn't look very hopeful. Alessio, should this have been linked more to the nuclear deal? Is there outside pressure that can be brought to bear? Or is this just one of those awful situations where we will watch, you know, the unfolding of a drama that we have nothing to do, you know, nothing to do to control?
So on the one hand, of course, there's always the question of can more be done? Well, I suppose, yes, absolutely. I mean, especially given the circumstances of the case, something definitely can be done. But it seems to me at the moment that provided what we've seen over the past few weeks of the opposition to the Iranian deal coming from various lobbies, particularly sort of in the Jewish community in the United States, and the difficulty to implement it in weeks ahead, it looks as if the current situation in his case is not a very happy one. And I would be surprised if a tremendous amount of or the necessary amount of political pressure were to be brought to bear, provided that on the scales of balance, I suppose the Iranian deal does matter a lot politically. And so here we're facing a classic dilemma: where does the sort of the story of the individual fit into a much more complicated dilemma?
Roger, you know, we've just seen two reporters for Vice arrested in Diyarbakir in Turkey today. The story of Jason Rezaian, it's still the age-old story. A journalist is endlessly confused with being a spy. And we don't really have any evidence in this case that's what happened, is there?
No, not at all. His main problem was he's binational. He's Iranian and American passports, and so he becomes very vulnerable to being taken as a judicial hostage. And I'm afraid the situation will continue probably until December, when the IEA releases its verification report, and it will be clear that the deal is going to go ahead full strength, and sanctions will be lifted. Until then, there's going to be this limbo where hardliners play every card they've got, and one of them is this bloke.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Roger Boys, and Alessio Patilano. Coming up next, we're going to look at flags and Kanye West.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
What we're trying to do is to keep our tentacles spread far and wide, I suppose, for this vast, vast country and this really dynamic city too here in Toronto, to try and bring the most accurate and the most vibrant flavour we can of this place that we hold so dearly to us.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Roger Boys, and Alessio Patilano. Now, we've been covering for some time the story of the New Zealand flag, and I think Alessio has been just given a tip off who might win, but they've been whittling down the numbers. They've gone down from 40 to 4 in the final shortlist. This is an attempt to get rid of the old colonial style flag and have something that expresses, you know, the hopes and aspirations of the nation today. The New Zealand Prime Minister has said that he likes the Silver Fern, as has the All Blacks captain, Richie McCaw. Well, we've got the four kind of shortlisted designs, and I must say there's another bit at the end of this where they may actually, the winner of this section then goes up against the existing flag. So the existing flag may still win, we don't know, and it's quite likely that it could actually still remain at the tops of flagpoles. Roger, the four designs, three very similar, which is the fern, and the other, which is a kind of a curled fern, come Maori symbol, the Korubo Andrew Fife. Is there any of these that stand out for you?
Well, I like the ones that look like the Islamic State flag most.
These are the black and white ones.
The black and white ones, yes.
And there was some debate that they were too Islamic State in the run-up to this vote.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think it's a very bad principle not only to mimic Islamic State, but also to mimic the colour of your rugby shirt. I don't quite see that that's what a flag is all about. Because I'm stupid this way, I'm a bit sad to see that the Union Track has dropped out of the picture altogether, because that's the whole point of the thing. And I guess the Silver Fern, I suppose that's in a way a mimicking of Canada. I mean, that's to say, taking a bit of your horticulture and deciding that that's the most interesting, important and non-offensive aspect of your society, and therefore plop it on your flag. And I'm not sure that I completely follow the logic or the beauty of it. So I think I'm settling for the most colourful, really, because it just would look better on T-shirts.
That's the silver fern at the bottom with the red and the blue.
Red, blue, four stars, which represent the islands, I suppose, and the silver fern. But at the moment, the silver fern, it just looks like one of these Christmas trees that you discard on January the 6th and throw out of your window. They look sad, depleted. And I wouldn't want to be a New Zealander with a flag like that.
Alessio, in your choice of pot plant or wave?
No, I think
you've only got a few seconds to tell me, by the way.
Okay, so I'm going to go for the fashion choice.
The fashion choice?
Yes, the blue and red one.
Okay.
Sounds much better than blue and black. I mean, blue and black would have been my favourite, but just black and blue, this just, no, quite right. On the other hand, I do think that people should be, you know, having the right to choose where flag should represent them, and, you know, so be it. They want a silver fern, so be it.
Now, we're going to squeeze in one final topic, which is an American popular music star called Mr. Kanye West. Yesterday said that he may be standing for president in 2020. Maybe a bit of a stunt. He apparently said that he had smoked something before coming on stage. But Roger, do we take these things serious? You know, can you imagine the contenders lining up? It would be quite nice to see Mr. Trump versus Mr. West.
Yeah, I mean, the situation's opened up because we have this rather boring dynastic struggle between the Bushes and the Clintons, and people really are so desperate. They want a stunt. They want something new and different. Unlike Britain, which is about to choose as the head of the Labour Party a guy who thinks he's stuck in 1975. I'm okay with musicians and rock musicians. And I think Paderewski was Prime Minister of Poland. Why, in the 20s, why on earth not have someone called West as the President of America? I think it works quite well. West Wing, it might work.
Alessio, if we look at his, we don't know if it's a joke or it was just one of those daft things that people say when they've had a bit too much entertainment backstage. But on a sensible point, he does touch for a youth vote. Does he say something about, would he be a good spokesman for the issue of violence against black people? Would he be able to represent something of that? Do you think there's anything, any merit in what he has to say?
Well, there is merit into someone who has great visibility, has great communicative powers, because that's what he does with the younger generations. There he's got a lot of merit in that, in using that as a role model to communicate something. Does he stand any kind of credibility? Not really. I mean, let me put it this way. We're having this discussion here. I think you're absolutely right. There is an element there, Roger, of if Donald Trump is standing for a presidential election, then anybody else really can do the same. But he's symptomatic of a certain malaise in the society, because they're tired of seeing the same type of people coming up. And these people represent presented the alternative option. But again, as I said, between that and the serious step of taking into consideration the importance of the office itself, there's a massive gap. And, you know, a pop star needs to do a lot of soul searching before being taken sort of seriously for that. But as I say, there's lots of potential there, and precisely because of the position under the spotlights that these people have.
But do you think, very quickly, and we literally have 20 seconds here, Roger, but him versus Trump, do you think on paper they probably have the same credibility, don't they?
Yes, hairstyle. Yeah, it could work. And I know, Alessia, forgot to mention, of course, Berlusconi, another great singer.
Absolutely.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. Roger Boys and Alessia Patilano, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. That's all we will have time for on the show. Today's show, it was produced by Ben Rylan. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and by Paige Reynolds, and also by Aidan McLaughlin. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, Ben Rylan Ryland will be keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. Then the 1900 hours, it's Josh Fennett with Section D. The Monocle Daily, if you want to hear what's going on, you can tune into that tonight as well. But for me, Andrew Tuck, that's all we have time for on today's show.